Well, again, I hope you all had a wonderful Christmas celebration. And again, we've been following the church calendar. So in the church calendar, the season of Advent, as we said, whether we follow it all or not, is that time of fasting, yearning, preparation, longing, come, O come, Emmanuel, looking forward to the coming of our Savior. And then historically, the 12 days of Christmas, which kind of is known only for that very, very annoying song that you hear and you're like, oh no, there goes 7 minutes, 8 minutes of my life that I'm going to have to endure. But nonetheless, it's 12 days of season of celebration in the coming of our Savior. And still in this celebration, we look forward to the celebration of his second coming. Well, as Mark said, it does seem like we've gotten very apocalyptic here at Affirmation on the Christmas Eve service. Our pre-Christmas text was Revelation 19, not your typical run-of-the-mill Christmas homily, but nonetheless an important one. And that's the theme that we're taking up. And that's right. We need to find times to talk about this. And we need to make sure that Christmas does not become for us mere sentimentality, but rather is we see it for what it is, the coming of the King. And when the king comes, the rival kings get antsy and war tends to break out. People don't like to be unseated. People don't like to give back power. You'll remember the parable of the workers in the vineyard when the workers are working the vineyard and the time comes for the master to take the vineyard back. And he sends his servants out to tell them, hey, it's time to give the vineyard back to the vineyard owner. And they kill the messengers. They're not going to give it back. And after cycles of this, finally the master says, well, surely I'll send my son. And if I send the inheritor of the vineyard out to speak with the workers, certainly they'll see the son and they'll give it back to him. But when the workers see the son, they think to themselves, well, here he is. Here's the heir of the vineyard. If we kill him, there'll be no one to give it to and then we'll have it. And this is what happens. People don't like to give back what they've had. They don't like to give back authority. And this period from the fall of Adam till the time of Christ, you have had these powers that have, they've seized power by the sovereign hand of God, turning things over to Satan, if you will, into darkness, that it might reign. And we have to deal with the consequences of our own sin against God and our, as R.C. Sproul says, our own cosmic treason. We have chosen other overlords and they have not treated us well. But Christmas is the coming of our King. The king to reclaim the throne for himself, to purchase his people back. That's what we celebrate. And that's apocalyptic. There's no way around it. There are sentimental feelings, but it's so much more than that. Well, today, again, another unusual text, but a wonderful text in Revelation chapter 12. Now, again, I don't know how familiar you are with Revelation. I know we preached through it, but now it was several years ago, and you come back to text and you kind of forget, and some stuff kind of makes sense, but it's very challenging. And when you read Revelation 12 and you've got this woman and you got stars under her feet and you got a dragon and he's sweeping stars out of the sky and he's gushing out water and the earth's opening up to swallow it, you can get lost in those details. But what we have here in Revelation 12 is a wonderful and grand vision of essentially the whole Bible. The story of the scriptures, if you will, are all kind of compressed and condensed into Revelation 12. You'll remember that Revelation is a series of visions telling the story of really Christ's first coming to his second coming. There are seven of these cycles of visions that tell the story and then retell the story and then retell the story, each of them from a little different angle, helping us understand, giving us an imaginative view, not a false view, but an imaginative view, giving us metaphors and images and lenses by which we can think about things in our time, the rulers of our time, the seductions of our time, the historical events of our time, the calamities of our time, all these things. We're given lenses and metaphors and imaginative pictures by which we are being told the meaning of the things that are happening in our time. Revelation 12 is one of these cycles, is the beginning of one of these cycles. But what's unique about Revelation 12 is it goes back before the first coming of Christ. It's really the only vision that does this. It takes us back, if you will, to the beginning. So let's just think through the narrative of the thing, and then I want us to look at some of the key characters: the woman, the dragon, the child, and the offspring. So what's the narrative? Well, we have this woman, and she is radiant and she is glorious. And we see her in this heavenly, if you will, archetypal image. And this woman, in this case, represents Old Testament Israel. Remember, you'll remember last week when we thought about Mary and how the angel came to Mary, Angel Gabriel came to Mary, this virgin bride, if you will, of God, who was obedient to the word of God and gave birth to Messiah. And we said that Mary is almost a condensation, a personification of all the Old Testament Israel. This is what Israel was to be. Israel was to be a virgin bride of God, obedient to God, let it be done unto me as you will, and through whom came Messiah, a gift to the world. That's Mary. But Mary is a picture of what Israel was supposed to be. And this vision in Revelation 12 is a heavenly, imaginative picture of Israel, the bride of God, who is called to give birth to a child. And so we have this woman and Satan, this red dragon who is ruling, right? He's got this seven heads. He has a lot of authority. He's got diadems. It's a royal figure. Right, Satan is the one who, if you will, is seated on the throne of this age. Power has been given over to him by the sovereign hand of God, and he has the pictures and the symbols of power, these diadems. And he is, what's he doing in heaven? He is looking at this woman, and he's kind of just stalking her. He knows that she's pregnant. He knows that Israel is going to give birth to Messiah, and Satan is stalking this woman, just waiting for her to give birth that he might devour the child. And then the woman gives birth. But Satan can't get to the child. The child, we're told, is snatched up into heaven. He's taken away. And in that little bit, that little, and the child was snatched up to heaven, is the whole story of Jesus Christ. All of that is condensed in this vision to the child was snatched up to heaven. And then Satan is cast out of heaven. There he is in heaven. And what's he doing? He's accusing the people of God. He's like a prosecutor there in the throne room, the heavenly throne room and courthouse of God. And he's accusing the saints day and night. But when the child is snatched up to heaven, we're told Satan is cast down to the earth. He's cast out of the courtroom. He has no more access to the courtroom of God. No longer is he allowed to accuse the people of God, and he's cast out. And now he knows his days are short. As Martin Luther sings, lo, his doom is sure. His head, we know from elsewhere in the scriptures, has been crushed, and it's only a matter of time before he bleeds out. It's only a matter of time before the nerves go dead. But right now, he's like a lion seeking whom he may devour. He's like a serpent with a bruised head thrashing around, you know, trying to wound those around him and do as much damage as he can. So the word says, oh, woe to you on earth, because he knows his days are short, his days are numbered. Well, what does he do on earth? Well, he goes back after the woman. He seeks to get the woman, but the woman is taken away from him. He can't do it. She's actually taken out into the wilderness and preserved there for what the text says, 1,290 days, or a time and half a time, that 3.5 years. And we don't have time to make the case for all these things, so you have to take your pastor's word for it, that this 1,290 days, this 3.5 years represent this period of time between the first and second coming of Jesus Christ, a time of trouble for the church, a time of persecution, but a time that's ultimately short and limited. It's not unending. It will come to an end. And for this whole period of time, the woman is taken out into the wilderness and the serpent cannot get to her. He wants to destroy her, but he can't get to her. So we're told at the end, what does he do? He goes after her offspring, the rest of her offspring, namely you and me. And so we'll make this case as we go. But I want you to just have that narrative refresh. So the woman, the dragon stalking, the child's born, the child casts this Satan out of the heavenly courtroom, and Satan comes to make war on the church. So let's think about these images for a second. As we think about Christmas, but then as we think about the implications of Christmas for us, for the church, what should we expect in our age? Well, first, the woman. In the beginning, we have this woman, this glorious woman, this woman in heaven with the sun, moon, and stars under her feet. You'll remember the, maybe if you want a point of connection in the Old Testament, because the best way always to interpret Revelation is with the Old Testament. You must have your, you must have knowledge of your Old Testament when you come to Revelation, because John is drawing us so many wonderful images from the Old Testament. And if you remember, if you can think back, if we're in Sunday school, we discuss here a little bit and think through what images come to your mind when you think of this woman with the sun, moon, and stars under her feet. And maybe what would come to your mind is the vision of Joseph. When Joseph is there with his brothers, remember, and he gets this vision of Israel and the stars, the sun and the moon even bow down before him. This image of the stars and the sun and the moon was what was this picture of Israel. And so here we have this woman who is Israel and described in ways in which John is just giving us these little touch points, or Christ through John, little touch points, so we understand who we're dealing with when we're talking about this woman, right? If we read Revelation wrong, then we're thinking, oh, there's going to be a woman someday. You know, this is a picture of Israel. And her whole mission, the reason Israel is chosen by God, is that through her, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Israel, the reason Israel exists, is that through her, all the nations of the earth might be blessed. That is, we know she is to give birth to Messiah, through whom the sin of the world will be removed and all nations of the earth will be blessed. But there is a dragon stalking her. Throughout her history, this dragon is stalking her, looking for this child that he might destroy it. The dragon knows that the child that she is pregnant with is going to be his undoing. And hence the story of Israel, when we read her story in the Old Testament, we see these conflicts. We see the dragon stalking. We see the dragon doing his damage. Even if we go back to the first woman, we come to Eve, we see the dragon. The serpent is there. The dragon knows that the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent. He knows the prophecy before it's given. And there he is stalking, seeking to destroy. We see it in the very story of Joseph that we saw, right? Joseph is born and Satan comes in and through the brothers to destroy and to undo Joseph, this chosen son. We see it in the story of David and Saul. David, the man after God's own heart, that's going to be this great king, and Satan coming, this evil spirit coming into the heart of Saul that he might destroy David. Story after story throughout Israel's history, either by threat and intimidation, by seduction and deception, the dragon is seeking to destroy this woman and waiting for this child that he might destroy the child. And the climax of this, we know, finally comes with Herod. When Jesus is born, Herod, the rival king, if you will, Satan's king, seeks the child that he might kill him. But again, he's snatched away down to Egypt and unable. Satan is unable in that sense to unable to get his hands on him. And so the child is born. And the child is Christ. And when Christ is born, we see Satan coming after him. We see Jesus tempted in the wilderness. Jesus meets him head on in the wilderness, and they do battle. We see Satan trying to get Jesus away from his mission through the mouth of Peter. Right? Who do you say that I am? You are the Christ. Okay, I must suffer and die. No, it will never be. Get behind me, Satan. Jesus knows. He sees the dragon. He hears the voice of the dragon, even in the words of Peter, seeking to derail him from his mission. So we see this battle continuing. Now, in our text, we get none of that. In our text, we just get, and the child was snatched up to heaven. But we know the rest of the story, the part of the story that John is not telling in this particular vision. We know that there was this battle between Jesus and Satan, and we know how Satan was overcome. Jesus goes to the cross. Jesus dies, he's raised again from the dead, and he ascends to heaven. He is snatched up, if you will, to heaven. The whole story is condensed in that one little phrase. And what happens when Jesus goes to heaven? What happens as Jesus takes his place at the right hand of the Father? What does Christmas mean for us? What is going on in the heavens? There are these moments in the Bible where you get visions of the heavenly courtroom, right? Like in the book of Job. Job has no idea what's going on. But we get a vision. We get to hear what's happening up in the heavenly courtroom. Well, also here, what happens after Christmas? What happens after the Christ child bears our sin and dies and is raised from the dead and is taken up into heaven? What happens? Well, we looked at it in Zechariah chapter 3. In Zechariah chapter 3, in some sense, we get a vision, again, of what's happening in this very text. In heaven, we have a picture of this courtroom, and Satan, which means accuser, the enemy of God's people, is standing there accusing Joshua, the high priest. Joshua is the representative of God's people, right? The high priest, that's what he does. And Joshua is, we know, and we've looked at this text before, is supposed to be wearing white robes when he comes into the presence of God as a symbol of the purity that is demanded when you come into the presence of God. But in this text, the text we read in our Old Testament reading, what is Joshua wearing? Joshua's clothes, we're told, are filthy. That is, Joshua's dirty. He's unclean. And he's standing before the angel of the Lord, and there is Satan right to his right accusing him, pointing out his filthy garments before the judge, the angel of the Lord. And what's fascinating about that vision is that Satan's accusations are not inaccurate. It's not like Joshua standing in clean robes and Satan's accusing him. Joshua is standing in filthy robes and Satan's accusing him. That is to say, Satan's accusations are accurate. Joshua is guilty before the presence of the Lord. And Satan, therefore, he's on solid ground, even in the courtroom of God, leaning on the holiness of God to say, hey, by all accounts, he should be judged. You're holy. He's sinful. He should be damned. But then in our text, in Zechariah, the Old Testament text, the angel of the Lord stands, rebukes Satan. He does not deny the claim. He actually says, this is Joshua, whom I have chosen. Is he not a brand plucked from the fire? I take from that sooty, dark, right? Soiled, dirty. I know he's dirty. I chose him. There's no denial of the accusation. But then he casts Satan out of the courtroom. I rebuke you, Satan. And he's cast out of the courtroom. And then we're told, he stands up and he says, take his filthy garments off of him. And they take the filthy garments off of him. And then the angel of the Lord interprets what he does. And he says, see, Joshua. And now remember, Joshua, Israel, let this be a representative of all of God's people. See, O church, see Israel, see Joshua. Do you see what I've done? I have taken your iniquity away from you. And then he does not leave him naked, but rather he commands those around him now to put white robes on him, clean white robes. And Zechariah can't control himself. He actually pipes up and he says, put a clean turban on too. And so, all right, fine, put a turban. And now Joshua stands in clean clothes, not because Joshua has done anything, but because his filthy garments have been taken off, his clean white robes have been put on, and therefore the accuser is cast out of the courtroom. And that's what we have happening in Revelation chapter 12. Jesus the Son is snatched up into heaven, and now war is made against Satan, and Satan is cast out of the courtroom. The accuser is silenced. This is what Christmas means for us. Satan's accusations do not stand against me anymore. Not because I'm a great guy. Not because I finally cleaned up my act, not because I finally got my stuff together, but because I have been forgiven. My filthy robes, because of Christ, have been removed. And clean white robes have been placed on me. Now, something even Zechariah's vision doesn't tell us is what happens to the dirty robes. God is holy. He can't just dismiss the dirty robes, but we know the rest of the story. We know that the judge himself takes the dirty robes. That was what Christ came to do, to take Joshua's dirty robes off of him and to put them on himself, and to take his clean robes off and put them on Joshua. That beautiful double transfer that happens in the gospel. It is on the basis of this that Satan is cast from the courtroom. And in the vision, he's cast to earth. And so what happens? Well, we hear the word, woe to you who are on earth, for Satan is PO'd. Satan knows his days are short. And what does he do? He comes after the woman. Now here, we just need to make one little distinction. And this, again, we can make it more, and maybe we can talk about it later. That in the book of Revelation, a distinction is made between the church proper, the church as an institution, the church as an entity, the church as the bride, the church as the temple, the church as the people. And one thing Revelation shows us consistently throughout the book is that entity is untouchable. That entity is unassailable. That entity is unharmable. The bride will not be touched. But the people who make up the bride. And this is the distinction you got to make in Revelation. The people who make up the bride, which in this case are called the offspring. Right? We are the church, and yet I am the offspring of the church. We are the church. I am part of the church, but I am the offspring of the church. Several places in Revelation that would be interesting to look at, we see this dichotomy. The temple will not be touched, but the outer courts will be trampled. The woman will not be touched. She's taken out into the wilderness, unassailable. He tries to get her. The earth opens up and swallows the flood. Can't be touched. The church cannot be touched, but Christians can be. The stones of the temple can be. The people that make up the bride can be. So in this case, the woman is taken out. She's untouched and preserved. But then he draws its attention to the offspring of the church, namely to you and me. And this brings us back now to our word of exhortation today from 1 Peter 5. Beware. Beware. Satan is like a lion, prowling, seeking whom he may devour. He's angry. He knows his days are short, and he will make war against the church. Christmas is our salvation. Christ has been snatched up to heaven. Satan has been cast out. And now for the church, it is a season of war. And we ought to be prepared for it. The text tells us, in verse 17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and who have the testimonies of Jesus Christ. Now, how does Satan make war with us? And one thing I love about this text is it gives us all these names for Satan, like up in verse 9. It says, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world, was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And in all those little names and all those little descriptions, we get a vision of the enemy that we're up against, right? He is Satan, which means the accuser. How will Satan, how does Lucifer, how does the devil make war against you? Well, one is by accusation. In heaven, he has no accusation to make, but he will accuse you. You will feel it. This is one of the battles we have to wrestle with as Christians when we engage with the evil one himself, is the voice of the accuser in our ears. He will come after you and your conscience. But he will also come after us as the devil. What does devil mean? The deceiver, the liar. This is another way in which he makes war against us. He comes to seduce. He comes to woo us away from God and from Christ our Savior, as he did with Eve, seducing her away from her confidence in God, drawing her attention to something that he claimed she could have, but in fact she could not have, getting her to distrust her God who had been so good and kind and gracious to her. And Satan does the same thing with us. If we read on in Revelation, we will see it will not be long before we are introduced to the harlot, the seductress, who woos people, seduces people away from the bridegroom, seduces people away from Christ with all the allures of